Well, just coming up at 7 after this programme, Paul Herriot will have the highlights from a special concert to mark the 50th anniversary of the death of Sean O'Riordan. Among the works that the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by David Brophy, will play is O'Riordan's Hercules Jux Ferrariae, which was first performed in 1957 by an earlier incarnation of that same orchestra. I've been doing some searching around the RTÉ archive to see if I could find a suitable clip to whet your appetite for the concert. There's so much there in the archives, but I thought this one might be of interest. It's an interview with O'Riordan around the time of the launch of an LP of his music under the title Vertical Man. The interviewer is Liam Nolan, and they start by talking about Hercules Jux Ferrariae and how and why it was composed. But the conversation turns to a much broader survey of the music of the time in Ireland, Europe and beyond. And O'Riordan responds to the questions with great candour, giving his opinion that, for instance, the Chieftains have no future. Now, this was 50 years ago, so I'm not sure if he's been proven right on that score. He also has trenchant criticisms of the Beatles and their collaborations with Ravi Shankar, and even Fairport Convention come in for his ire. Now, whether we agree or not, I think it gives a good picture of O'Riordan himself when he was a vertical man, in the sense that Auden meant it when he wrote, "Let us honour, if we can, the vertical man, though we value none but the horizontal." Here is Sean O'Riordan talking to Liam Nolan in 1970, just a year before his death.
Mr. O'Riordan, I'm sure that congratulations must be in order on the publication now of this new record. In fact, it's not the first time that, I wonder if my pronunciation is correct, Hercules Jux Ferrariae Nomus Number 1. Is that correct?
Yes. Hercules Jux Ferrariae sounds like the Artful Dodger.
It means
I think
what?
Jux Ferrariae.
Jux.
Yes. It was... it's a tune that was used by Josquin des Prez and by Cyprien de Rore in the 15th and 16th centuries in honour of the first Duke of Ferrara as the basis for a cyclic mass originally, and it really goes Ferrariae Dux Hercules, and rhyming with that you get the old European Guidonian terminology, Re Fami Re Ut Re Ut Re Ferrariae Dux Hercules, you see?
Oh, I see, yes.
So it went Re Fa Mi Re Ut Re Ut Re, which was Hercules Dux Ferrariae, or Ferrariae Dux Hercules. And I just took this motif they used and used it again. I mean, if Cipriano used it after Josca, so I felt quite entitled to use it after Cipriano.
It's probably an impossible question to ask somebody, particularly a composer, but can you remember what it was that attracted you about it in the first place to make you want to work on it?
I think I probably was impressed by it as a student, by the cyclic master Josquin wrote, and feeling that it had capacity for development and that I would like to do my own thing with it.
What precisely did you set out to do with it?
Well, I'll tell you, it was extraordinary in a way. I never thought in my life to be performed. We had just moved from a flat in Monkstown to a house in a place called Galloping Green, Number 1 Galloping Green. For a couple of weeks, we hadn't got furniture or things like that properly organized. And I remember writing most of it lying flat down on the floor. And I was writing it just as an experiment for myself to see what would happen. A kind of voyage of discovery for myself, to discover what really this thing meant to me. And I didn't really mean it to be performed. I don't say I didn't mean it to be performed. I just didn't think of performance. I just did it as you sit down and you work out whatever question it is. I suppose a mathematician would sit down and work out a complex equation for himself to find out something about the nature of music.
Now, you said one very interesting thing there also. You said that you wrote it lying flat down on the floor. Is this your normal position for writing?
No, it's not.
Why were you then in this particular...
Because in my office at that time, in my, if you like to dignify it by the name of study, I didn't have a table. Now I have a table. I write sitting at a table.
How long did it take you to write all together?
Oh, it took a very short time. It took just less than 3 months.
I remember once being involved, in fact, writing a biographical novel of Smetana, the composer, and being astonished in a way again when one does the research is to find that, for instance, I think when he wrote the Moldau, that he never literally heard it. He never heard Bohemia's Woods and Fields properly because at that time he was going deaf and he was also becoming mad. How long was it after you had completed the draft, if that's the correct word, before you were able to hear it either transposed for piano or whatever?
Well, I could never dream of it for anything else except for strings. And here may I let a short blast at composers who use pianos. Benjamin Britten now, for example, uses the piano when he's composing. This must be a crutch.
Now, why do you
say that? Any man who has to use a piano to compose, who writes three or four bars and then goes over and sits down at the piano and tries them out again, and then writes another three or four bars and then gallops over to the piano and does it again. And I saw a film made about Britten by some friends of his some years ago, in which he had assented to, apparently, and this was given as his method of composition. I think you have to be able to consider or to conceive the whole work in terms of the forces for which it's being written. And any other things then, like the piano, would come in as a gap. Mahler now, for example, whom I regard as probably one of the greatest modern composers with regard to orchestration, you couldn't imagine that he would use a piano because it's conceived entirely in terms of orchestra.
Now, let me talk to you briefly about composing in Ireland in general. Are you happy that there are a sufficient number of people of a sufficiently high standard composing?
Well, we're a very small country. We can't support a large number of composers. You're lucky if you get one out of 2.5 to 3 million, which is our population. I'm not saying I'm the one, but I'm saying you are lucky if you do get one who is a good composer. I think it would be foolish for us to regard all our composers as being good composers. Again, I'm not saying I'm a good one or a bad one. I'm leaving that up to other people to decide. I feel that we are doing the best we can for our composers, that the composers in this country, generally speaking, have a pretty good opportunity.
How far do you think that composers, when they are writing, particularly in a traditional idiom, should try to modernize tradition?
Well, now when you say a traditional idiom, I presume you mean a traditional European idiom.
Yes.
Well, now, there is a fundamental question there, which would take us about 3 hours every day to answer.
Which I'm sure you do most effectively at UCC. Is it an impertinence of me to ask you if you could encapsulate your thoughts on that?
Yes, well, you see, the European tradition at the moment is painted into a corner. And I don't see much future for the European tradition at the moment unless it can adapt itself to the world as it is. And the world as it is, and something which we fail to realize all the time, we talk about the common market, we talk about Europe, we talk about all this kind of carry on. The largest sector of humanity living in the world today is living in Asia. Very few people in Europe and less people in Ireland know anything at all about Oriental music. The music of China, the music of the Korean novices in Korea, the classical court music of Japan, the Indian rags, which were superficially treated by some Beatle people, but very superficially. They just took over the sound without taking over the meaning. The music of Asia generally, which the music of the world's largest landmass and of the world's largest population, is entirely ignored. And we spend our time, year after year after year, getting poor old Beethoven to revolve in his grave every 20 minutes of every day. Whether this is happening in America, or in Ireland, or in Australia, or in England, or elsewhere.
In fact, when you mentioned the Beatles there, or Beatle-type people, I think you said, the name Ravi Shankar was going through my mind, and the use of the sitar by certain pop groups. Do you think, though, that what they are doing is a healthy thing, to at least explore what is happening in other places, even if they don't scratch the surface of it?
No, I don't think so. I think they're just trying to bolster up their own failing vitality and virility. They take what suits them and immediately corrupt it to their own horrible 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, tonic dominant, tonic dominant, tonic dominant, tonic dominant harmony and rhythm.
Is that the same sort of judgment that you would place on something that we heard? Now, it's difficult to ask you to pass a judgment on this because probably you weren't there, but at the National Stadium on Monday, one night this week, we had a beat group called Fairport Convention appearing on the same bill as the Chieftains. Mm. And the first part of the program was, of course, the ethnic Irish traditional tunes and treatment of the Chieftains. Mm. And then the rather extraordinary mixture in the beat group of a traditional fiddler from England and the incorporation into the sounds they were making of traditional rhythms. Is this a kind of departure that you would think, in no matter how tenuous a way, is a good movement for our music?
Well, no. This is, again, an involved question and therefore an involved answer. Regarding what the Chieftains are doing, I cannot feel but anything but sympathy, because the Chieftains are a subsection of my own group, Kiltoirí Chualainn. And undoubtedly, they would not have come into existence except for the existence of Kiltoirí Chualainn. Therefore, I can't very well, just as a father can't repudiate his own son.
Indeed.
I can't repudiate what they are doing. In fact, I admire what they are doing. But it has tremendous limitations. They are limited to doing this kind of thing. I can't see any future for them, which is why I have disbanded Kiltoirí Chualainn, the parent group. With regard to the other group, the Fairport Convention, I feel that they are doing, again, what the beat groups are doing when they have somebody playing the sitar. They're just scraping the surface of somebody else's tradition and using it. They are keeping themselves going with infusions of other people's culture. Now, I think the future lies with neither group, really. The future must come out of some kind of new synthesis whereby traditional musicians who understand and appreciate both the European thing and the Oriental thing, as their own thing, can have a new takeoff point.